This is the WGBH Forum Network.
This evening's event is devoted to A.E. Housman, one of the most important poets, critics, and prose stylists of the late 19th and early 20th centuries. And our two speakers this evening are in fact the co-directors of the Editorial Institute at Boston University. Archie Burnett, born in Scotland, was educated at the universities of Edinburgh and Oxford. He was a junior research fellow at St. John's College, Oxford, and professor and head of English studies at Oxford Brookes University. He is currently a professor of English at Boston University. He's an established Milton scholar, but he's best known for his scholarly Oxford editions of the poems of A.E. Housman, which was issued in 1997, and the letters of A.E. Housman, which we're celebrating this evening, published just last year. He's also begun work on a complete edition with commentary of the poems of Philip Larkin for Faber and Faber. Christopher Ricks is Warren Professor of the Humanities at Boston University. He's also currently Professor of Poetry at Oxford and President of the Association of Literary Scholars and Critics. His numerous books include, and I'll mention just a few this evening, Essays in Appreciation, Beckett's Dying Words, T.S. Eliot and Prejudice, and Keats and Embarrassment. He's edited the poems of Tennyson, Browning, and Housman, and he's the editor of the New Oxford Book of Victorian Verse and the Oxford Book of English Verse, out of which he gave us a marvelous lecture just 6 years ago. He's recently published Dylan's Visions of Sin, and just this last September, he very kindly gave a wonderful after-dinner talk for the Johnsonians in New York City on Johnson, Samuel Johnson, as a critic and as a poet. So I hope you will join me in welcoming and re-welcoming Archie Burnett and Christopher Ricks to the Boston Athenaeum as they present A.E. Housman, A Life in Letters.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Alfred Edward Housman was born on March 26, 1859, in the hamlet of Fotbury near Bromsgrove in Worcestershire, England, and died in the Evelyn Nursing Home in Cambridge on April 30, 1936. Though he was a very promising student at school and in his first year at Oxford, he failed his final examinations, securing only a pass degree. Nobody knows how this came about, though narrow concentration on textual scholarship at the expense of the broader curriculum, and possibly the realization that he was inclined towards homosexuality, seem the likeliest reasons. It's astonishing, and so far as I know, unique, to find in an application for a professorship a statement such as his in his letter of application in 1892 for the chair of Latin at University College London. "I failed," he says, "to obtain honours in the final school of literae humaniores." However, in the same letter of application, he remarks that during the last 10 years, the study of the classics has been the chief occupation of my leisure, and goes on to list his publications. These were so brilliant, his 12 referees wrote with such enthusiasm and respect, and he was so impressive at interview that from a higher division clerkship at Her Majesty's Patent Office, he was appointed Professor of Latin. In 1911, he became Professor of Latin at Cambridge and a Fellow of Trinity College. He was by common recognition one of the very greatest textual scholars of Latin and Greek. His collected classical papers fill 3 substantial volumes, and he produced editions of Manilius's Astronomica, Juvenal, and Lucan. He was also, as you know, a very fine poet, though his first collection, A Shropshire Lad, published in 1896, was favourably reviewed, it took over 2 years to clear the print run of 500 copies. But the Great War established his fame, and in 1922, when the ominously titled Last Poems was published, he was a best-selling poet. The poems have been set to music by over 50 composers, and his popularity endures. His two collections of poems, slim though they are, have never been out of print. Such in outline is his public life. One of the reasons for editing his letters and for making the edition as complete as it can be is to give some sense of the life as he lived it, with as little distortion as possible. His reserve was legendary. His famous silences, socially awkward for everybody, his professional criticisms, withering and feared. But he was also an enthusiastic traveller and gourmet, a sociable man, generous with his money, and painstakingly courteous and kind. In short, he was a complex mixture of often contradictory impulses. No edition of his letters, of anybody's letters, can reveal everything, but it's in the letters that we get closer to Huysman than through any other source. This is nowhere more the case than in the letters published in the Oxford edition last year that relate to the relationship with Moses Jackson, the man he called his greatest friend and who, he said, had more influence on my life than anyone else, and who was responsible for my writing poetry. Huysman met Jackson in the summer of 1877 when they both won scholarships at St. John's College, Oxford. Huysman loved him, and though there could have been no reciprocation beyond friendship, his devotion to Jackson never waned. In October of 1922, when Last Poems was published to great acclaim, Huysman, who had no great liking for deluxe editions, fussed over getting a specially bound copy of the volume sent to Jackson, who was dying of stomach cancer in Vancouver. The volume was sold for £48,500 at Sotheby's in 2001 and bears the simple inscription MJJ from AEH. Accompanying it was a letter, the last letter that Huysman wrote to Jackson.
My dear Mo, I have been putting off writing so as to be able to send you this precious book, published today. The cheerful and exhilarating tone of my verse is so notorious that I feel sure it will do you more good than the doctor's, though you do not know, and there are no means of driving the knowledge into your thick head, what a bloody good poet I am. In order to intimidate you and repress your insolence, I'm enclosing the review and the leader which the Times devoted to the subject. I may also inform you that the copy of the first edition of my other immortal work which I gave you is now worth £8 or more if you have kept it at all clean, and that the average annual sale is over 3,000 copies. This is largely due to the war, because so many soldiers, including at least one VC, carried it in their pockets, and thus others got to know of it and bought it when they came home. But it does not seem to stop bullets, as the Bible does when carried in the pocket. So I have been disappointed of that advertisement, probably through the jealousy of the Holy Ghost. Of this new book, there were printed 4,000 copies for a first edition, which were all ordered by the booksellers before publication, so there is already a second edition in the press. It is now 11 o'clock in the morning, and I hear that the Cambridge shops are sold out. Please to realise, therefore, with fear and respect, that I am an eminent bloke, though I would much rather have followed you round the world and blacked your boots. In June, I flew over to Paris for a week, as usual, and late in the summer, I spent a month at Midhurst in about the best part of Surrey, between the Chalk Downs and the Haslemere type of country. I motored through Godalming. Whitley Common has been rather devastated by the Canadian camp there. Gerald writes to me now and then, and seems to be a wonder in the way of industry and determination. Both Oscar and Rupert evidently think a lot of him. My very kind regards to Mrs. Jackson. Yours very truly, A. E. Houseman.
Houseman was 63 at the time and professor of Latin at Cambridge, but noticed how he reverts to undergraduate banter whilst also declaring that he would much rather have followed Jackson round the world and blacked his boots. A similar sharp shock comes from the letter Houseman wrote to their student contemporary Alfred Pollard when Jackson died in January 1923. Pollard for a time shared rooms with the two of them in Oxford.
My dear Pollard, Jackson died peacefully on Sunday night in hospital at Vancouver, where he had gone to be treated for anemia, with which he had been ailing for some years. I had a letter from him on New Year's Day, which he ended by saying, "Goodbye. Now I can die myself. I could not have borne to leave him behind me in a world where anything might happen to him. Yours sincerely, A.E. Houseman."
Houseman maintained friendly relations with the Jackson family. The fourth son of Moses and Rosa Jackson, Gerald, was Houseman's godson. Houseman exchanged publications with him. I may say in their respective languages, Houseman would send him very detailed accounts of classical scholarship, and he would return with offprints of his articles in metallurgy. He also supported his godson's postgraduate study financially, and Gerald Jackson attended Houseman's funeral in Cambridge in 1936. Something of the openness of the friendship comes across in a letter Houseman wrote to Jackson's wife Rosa in 1908.
"Dear Mrs. Jackson, I'm sending you a copy of the latest edition of my poems, illustrated. I do not admire the illustration so much as I admire the poems, but it was done chiefly to please the publisher. I was glad to have your information about Mo. How did Rupert fare at Cambridge? A Merry Christmas to all of you. Yours sincerely, A.E. Houseman."
Shortly after Houseman's death in 1936, Rosa Jackson wrote to Houseman's brother Lawrence, "I have been honoured with his friendship for over 40 years, and my late husband, who was at Oxford with him, and all my sons, all loved him dearly." The poems that the relationship with Jackson prompted handle Houseman's feelings indirectly, though powerfully. Such letters, few though they are, contain the strongest direct evidence of those feelings. Houseman's life was not entirely or exceptionally a sad one. Following the death of his mother from cancer on his 12th birthday, when he was staying with the family of his godmother Elizabeth Wise, what is immediately striking is the young Houseman's staunch, unwavering loyalty to his stepmother, Lucy Agnes, and the warmth of the rapport. Houseman's younger brother, Lawrence, tells us that the seven children, of whom Alfred was the eldest, agreed with her that she should be called Mama, though later they switched to the more formal and grown-up Mater. Tellingly, not so for Houseman. He calls her my dear Mama and still addresses her thus when he's 54. Similarly, though in his youth he uses various forms of his own name, including Alfred Edouard Maisonhomme in a jokey letter in French to his godmother when he's 18, in 1881, with very few exceptions, he settles permanently for A.E. Houseman, even in your loving son, A.E. Houseman. His letters to his stepmother brim with youthful high spirits and humour, as well as with highly characteristic value judgments. Here are some of the things he says in a letter reporting on his first visit to London when he's 14.
"My dear Mama, I've now seen Oxford Street, Regent Street, Holborn, Cheapside, Cornhill, Piccadilly, etc., but not much of the Strand. On Wednesday we went to Waterloo Place, Pall Mall and St James Park, where I saw the band of the Grenadier Guards and some of the First Life Guards. Then we went to Trafalgar Square, which is quite magical, and to Westminster. I explored the North Transept, where the statesmen are. I looked at Pitt's and Fox's monuments and went into Poets' Corner. Service was at 3 with an anthem by Green, which was like a boa constrictor, very long and very ugly. We had a beautiful one by Gosse at the Chapel Royal in the morning. Yesterday I went to the British Museum and spent most of my time among the Greeks and Romans. I looked at your Venus, the townly Venus, in the alcove, but I do not admire her. What delighted me most was the Farnese Mercury. I examined some of the Nineveh bulls and lions, and I went through the zoological gallery. I met Cousin Henry there, but he had only 10 minutes to spare, and those were, of course, geological. I've come to the conclusion, which you may tell the readers of the centre of the earth, that if the Mastodon and Megatherium were to fight, it would decidedly be a very bad job for the Megatherium. I may also remark that the Ethiosauri and Plesiosauri are by no means so large or terrific as those met by Professor Hardwig and company. I like the view from Westminster Bridge and Trafalgar Square best of all the places I've seen, and I'm afraid you'll be horrified to hear that I like St. Paul's better than Westminster Abbey. The Quadrant, Regent Street and Pall Mall are the finest streets, but I think that of all I've seen, what has most impressed me is the guards. This may be barbarian, but it is true. I hope your cold is getting better. I'm serenaded every morning by some cocks who crow as if their life depended upon it. If they were in my hands, their life would depend upon it. With love to my father and all, I remain your affectionate son, A.E. Houseman.
The same buoyancy and boyishness come across in another letter to her 3 days after his 26th birthday, when he's working at the patent office in London.
My dear Mama, I was delighted to get your long letter on the 26th. It was quite the best epistle I have ever seen, with the possible exception of the second of the Apostle Paul to the Corinthians. The violets also were very sweet. I don't know whether St. Paul used to enclose violets. Also, please thank my father for his letter. Clements and Lawrence sent me a postcard with a very lovely drawing on the back representing cherubim and seraphim continually crying, and an inscription in Spanish or Portuguese, I think. The juvenile son of a friend of mine at the office has the loftiest ambition I have ever heard tell of. When he goes to heaven, which he regards as a dead certainty, he wants to be God and is keenly mortified to learn that it is not probable he will. However, his aspirations are now turning into another channel. It has come to his knowledge through the housemaid that the devil has horns and a tail, and in comparison with these decorations, the glories of heaven have lost their attractiveness. An elaborate new index of trademarks is being compiled at the office. It goes on very remarkable principles which I do not quite understand. Under the head of biblical subjects is included a picture of an old monk drinking out of a tankard, and the Virgin Mary and St. John the Baptist are put among mythical figures. I hope you and your household are well, and with love to my father and all, I remain your loving son, A.E. Houseman.
The two of them clearly shared a sense of humour, as is suggested in 1885, when he reports on jury service.
My dear Mama, you would never guess what I was doing on Tuesday week, serving on a coroner's jury. This comes of having one's name on the register of voters. Civil servants, I believe, are exempt from serving on ordinary juries, but not on coroners. Of course, for once in a way, it is rather amusing, and it's not likely to happen oftener than about once in 4 years. We sat on 5 bodies, one laundryman who tied 100 weight to his neck and tipped over into the water butt, one butcher's man who cut his throat with a rusty knife and died a week after of erysipelas. Moral, use a clean knife on these occasions. One old lady who dropped down in a fit, one baby who died in convulsions, and one young woman who died of heart disease after eating spring onions for supper. I really do not know what is the good of a jury or of witnesses either. The coroner does it all. His mind seemingly is lighted by wisdom from on high, so he tells the jury what their verdict is and the witnesses what their evidence is. If they make mistakes, he corrects them. The butcher's man had a brother-in-law. He looked radiantly happy. A member of his family had distinguished himself, and he was reveling in the reflected glory.
His stepmother enjoyed and encouraged his writing of light verses, something he did throughout his life. When a volume of Lawrence Houseman's religious poems is published in 1898, Houseman writes to her immediately.
I shall be interested to see the devotional poems. Perhaps I myself may write a hymn book for use in the Salvation Army. There is Hallelujah Hannah walking backwards down the lane, and I hear the loud hosanna of regenerated Jane, and Lieutenant Isabella in the centre room comes, dealing blows with her umbrella on the trumpets and the drums. Or again, Hallelujah was the only observation that escaped Lieutenant Colonel Mary Jane when she tumbled off the platform in the station and was cut in little pieces by the train. Hallelujah, Hallelujah, we will gather up the fragments that remain. It seems to come quite easy.
And she must have asked him for some verses when he replies on 21 March 1898.
The only poem that I can find is this. I know a Cappadocian who fell into the ocean. His mother came and took him out with tokens of emotion. She also had a daughter who fell into the water. At any rate, she would have fallen if someone hadn't caught her. The second son went frantic and fell in the Atlantic. His parent reached the spot too late to check her offspring's antic. Her grief was then terrific. She fell in the Pacific, exclaiming with her latest breath, "I have been too prolific."
A month or so later, it's again to his stepmother on the occasion of the marriage of her niece that he writes.
Marriage and the necessity of filling the sheet of paper remind me of one of my occasional poems, which I may or may not have told you of before. When Adam day by day woke up in paradise, he always used to say, "Oh, this is very nice." But Eve, from scenes of bliss, transported him for life. The more I think of this, the more I beat my wife.
Throughout his life, he kept in touch with all the members of his family, often visiting them during the summer vacations. His brother Basil, who was a doctor, was his favourite. Houseman once described him as the most normal among the family members. It was also to Basil that he sent many light verses for his amusement. When he died, Houseman kept in touch with his widow Jeannie and visited regularly. He was close to his sister Kate too, writing more letters to her than to any of the others. When she was very young, he used to tease her about her poor spelling, but he also went out of his way to amuse her, as in this high-spirited letter when he was a student at Oxford.
"My dear Kate, Sir," said the census taker, "the first thing is to write your name in full." I wrote down Albert Matilda Hopkins and waited for further instructions. We will now have, proceeded he, your relation to the head of the house. "My relations with the president," replied I, "are, I regret to say, rather strained. He makes me want to go to chapel every now and then in college, and I do not like it." "No," I continued, taking out my handkerchief and howling, "I can't bear it. I think I'd better fill up that column with downtrodden slave." I did so. "How old are you?" said he. 303, responded I. "You bear your great age well," he observed. "I bear your great impudence well," I retorted. "What restrains me, I wonder, from drawing my revolver from my breast pocket and blowing out your apology for a brain? What restrains me?" He trembled and was silent. Yet this was not a difficult question to answer. What restrained me was the fact that there was no revolver in my breast pocket. I then went on to tell him that I was married, privately, to the Queen, but she didn't want it known just yet, so we agreed that I'd better put myself down as a widow, which I did. "Where," said he, "were you born? Where," said I, snatching up the poker, "will you die? In that corner or in this, on or under the table, or on the ground outside the window? Oh, pray don't hurry," I continued as he rushed in terror from the apartment. "Wouldn't you like to ask some more questions? What my godfathers and godmothers did then for me? Or how, when, and where I like it? Or why Miller wears a white hat? Pray don't go," but he went. He told the porter that I was much more sublimer than a raging lion, and he hastily filled up the last column of my census paper with the words, "Imbecile, probably from birth." I went down and corrected into imbecile, probably from having been asked a string of impertinent questions. Finding that there was a good deal of room on the paper unoccupied, I filled it up by mentioning that my sister Kate was a woman of genius who had just written an affectionate and entertaining letter, and that though perhaps she spelt Napoleon with two A's instead of two O's, and put a grave accent over the E, and deprived immensely of an E, and presented it to dancing, yet she still was an ornament to her sex, and I remained her affectionate brother, A.E. Houseman. Then I had to scratch this out and put Albert Matilda Hopkins instead.
Towards his irrepressible brother Lawrence, poet, playwright, political activist, Houseman was consistently affectionate but teasing, as, for instance, at the end of 1896, the year in which A Shropshire Lad and Lawrence's collection Green Arras were published.
My dear Lawrence, I'm extremely anxious that you should spend a happy Christmas, and as I have it in my power, here goes. Last night at dinner, I was sitting next to Rendell, principal of University College Liverpool and professor of Greek there. Very nice fellow and a great student of Marcus Aurelius and modern poetry. He was interested to hear that you were my brother. He said he had got Green Arras, and then he proceeded, "I think it is the best volume by him that I have seen. The Shropshire Lad had a pretty cover. I remain your affectionate brother. What a thing is fraternal affection that it will stand these tests. A.E. Houseman, P.S. After all, it was I who designed that pretty cover, and he did not say that the cover of Green Arras was pretty, nor is it. P.P.S. I was just licking the envelope when I thought of the following venomed dart. I had far, far rather that people should attribute my verses to you than yours to me."
Houseman was also critical of Lawrence's writings. When Lawrence sent him poems for comment, as he did in the 1890s and early 1900s, Houseman would praise as he thought appropriately, but complain about Lawrence's besetting shortcoming, obscurity.
"My dear Lawrence, I've got your poems into what seems to me a rough order of merit. Love Bound Time, I think, is the most original, and it is very well written and quite as lucid as one can expect, though I rather doubt if the English language will allow the stanza beginning Beauty May to Beauty-er to mean anything in particular, however it sounds nice. Prisoner of Caresbrook ought certainly to be included, as it has more root in earth than most of its author's lays, and occupies the proud position of distinctly meaning something from beginning to end. What makes many of your poems more obscure than they need be is that you do not put yourself in the reader's place and consider how and at what stage that Man of Sorrows is to find out what it is all about. You are behind the scenes and know all the data, but he knows only what you tell him. It appears from the alternative titles Heart's Bane and Little Death that in writing that precious croon, you had in your head some meaning of which you did not suffer a single drop to escape into what you wrote. You treat us as Nebuchadnezzar did the Chaldeans and expect us to find out the dream as well as the interpretation. That is the worst instance, but there are others where throughout the first half of a poem, the hapless reader is clawing the air for a clue and has not enough breath in his body to admire anything that you show him. Take The Stolen Mermaid. I was some time in discovering who was talking, whether it was the stolen mermaid or the robbed merman. Their matters might be made clearer by altering the crabbed lines, O heart to captive be, into something like, This land-bound heart of me hears sound its mother sea, only better expressed, I hope. In the great ride, to begin with, you'd better add place as well as date to the title, or the allusion may easily be missed. You start off, Where the merciful waters roll. The reader sees the past tense, and instead of thinking of the heavenly Jordan as you want him to, he is off to Abana and Farfa, the rivers of Damascus, and expects to hear you tell him about some historical crossing of a river where a lot of people were killed, all of which you would avoid by saying, roll. Further, how soon do you imagine your victim will find out that you are talking about horses? Not till the 13th of these long lines, unless he is such a prodigy of intelligence and goodwill as I am. There you mention hoofs, and he has to read the 13 lines over again. Flank in line 6 is not enough. Swinburne's women have flanks. And as line 6 is at present a foot too short, I advise you to introduce hoofs into it, or tails. The Fire Worshippers is surely a very bad title and rather helps to confuse. Man, Truth and Beauty would be not good, I dare say, but better. Bowels, if terrific sublimity is what you're after, say Guts, which has the further advantage of being one syllable and not two, like Bowels, though I'm aware that Aten rhymes the latter with Howls, but nobody rent Prometheus bowels that I know of, so I should say sighed, like an ordinary creature.
At such moments, he does no more than he does when fastidiously drafting and redrafting his own poems and his notebooks. And the same unresting critical attention is levelled at his own poems as when he writes to J.W. McHale about the possible contents of last poems.
About Hell Gate, my troubles were first that the whole thing is on the edge of the absurd. If it does not topple over, that is well so far. Secondly, as you perceive, the texture of the diction, especially in the parts which I had to compose, is not what it should be, and I rather despair of mending it. It would not do simply to omit the passages you mention. I should have to put something in their place, and it probably would be nothing better. As to three consecutive initial ands, that occurs in the L'Allegro of my great exemplar, and Shelley in The Invitation, and again in Ariel to Miranda, has five. On page 43, I think the repetition has a certain value. On page 42, it is mitigated by the intervention of a full stop and offends the eye more than the ear. Exception is taken, as I foresaw it would be, to spruce on page 44. I think it is the right word and helps, like finery of fire, to keep the piece from being too solemn. And moreover, Milton talks about the spruce and jocund spring. The alternative is brave, which I like less, partly because it has the same vowel sound as failed in the next line. What do you think?
Such rigour is, of course, chiefly manifest in Houseman's classical scholarship, much of which, unfortunately, does not communicate to the non-specialist. Like Scaliger, Lachmann and Wilamowitz, Mohlendorf, all of whom he admired, he set about acquiring whatever knowledge might be necessary to understand the text, which meant writing letters asking experts about subjects ranging from planetary motion to coins. He acted as a prompt and unfailing answering service to numerous other classical scholars, such as J.W. McHale, A.B. Ramsey, A.F.F. Gow, and J.D. Duff, all of whom, to judge by the frequency with which they sought his views, benefited from his opinion on textual and related matters. When McHale sent him detailed comments on his edition of Manilius, Houseman's reply was equally detailed, and his comments to Dr. Frank Robbins on the Michigan Papyrus are also generously full. Unsparing of himself, he was unsparing of others who seemed to him to be presumptuous, vain or insufficiently informed. For instance, here is his response to Robinson Ellis, later Corpus Christi professor of Latin at Oxford, for having given him some information of the on the manuscripts of the Ibis of Ovid.
Dear Mr. Ellis, I'm glad to be able to make any sort of return for the information you have given me. So I write to tell you that on examining the Defloratio Brit Mus 18459, I find that your report of it is in error in one particular. It contains the verses 39 and 40, and it does not contain the verses 35 and 36. This explains the absence of any statement in your critical apparatus as to its reading quem or quam in 36. Yours very truly, A. Houseman. It has Tibby sit for sit Tibby in 109, but this perhaps is not worth mentioning.
W.M. Lindsay was another scholar he didn't see eye to eye with, largely because he thought Lindsay relied overmuch on paleographical solutions to scribal errors. When Lindsay sends him his pamphlet on Marshall in 1903, Houseman replies,
"My dear sir, I have waited to read your pamphlet on Marshall before thanking you for it, in order that I might be able to do so more intelligently. The collations and the collection of variants between the three sources will be very valuable, whether or not one adopts the theory to which you incline, that some of these latter go back to Marshall himself. I don't myself take this view, for very similar phenomena occur in the texts of other much-read authors, such as Virgil and Lucan, and seem to be part of the penalty they pay. I think, too, that the purely paleographical solution, which you praise at 2.22, is applicable to many other verses. Some of them are confusions I have met in all sorts of places, Pignus and Munus, Renovator and Revocator, Lasso and Fesso, Umbras and Undas, Capiat and Faciat, and others belong to common types of corruption, Gamina and Magni, Mular and Pluma, Surilos and Pusilos. But certainly no one can say that you put forward your opinion with any undue confidence, and the details you give are most interesting. I am yours very truly, A. Houseman.
Gracious it may not be, but knowledgeable it certainly is, and it shows that typically Houseman had been thinking independently. His formidable range of knowledge and lucidity of exposition are again in evidence when he turns his mind to Shelley's Ode to a Skylark. T.S. Eliot had written, I am still ignorant as to what sphere Shelley refers, or why it should have silver arrows, or what the devil he means by an intense lamp narrowing in the white dawn. This drew a response from a great height, from T. Sturge Moore, who said, what silver sphere? Though a schoolgirl would reply correctly, the moon's. Yet Mr. Eliot professes himself stumped. Of course the poem's simplicity satisfies the poetically gifted schoolgirl without forcing her to apply that brain work necessary to become conscious of its full implications any more than Mr. Eliot was compelled to expend it, Houseman wrote in to the newspaper.
To the editor of the Times, Sir, although this ode is not one of Shelley's best poems and enjoys more fame than it deserves, it is good enough to be worth interpreting. Quintilian says that you will never understand the poets unless you learn astronomy, and as this subject is not now much studied in girls' schools, it was only to be expected that Mr. Moore's Egeria should darken with misinformation the ignorance of Mr. Eliot. In the stanza, keen as are the arrows of that silver sphere whose intense lamp narrows in the white dawn clear until we hardly see, we feel that it is there. The silver sphere is the morning star, the planet Venus, and Shelley is giving a true description of her disappearance and using an apt comparison. The moon, when her intense lamp narrows in the white dawn clear, is not a sphere, but a sickle. When she is a sphere at sunrise, she is near the western horizon, visible in broad daylight and disappearing only when she sets, so that nothing could be less like the vanishing of the skylark.
At such times, it's only marginally better to have been T.S. Eliot than T. Sturge Moore. Though in professional life he was unbending, Houseman certainly knew how to enjoy himself. At New Year in Cambridge, he would eat as many oysters as he could and wash them down with stout, after which, as he used to say, quoting the advert for Mrs. Winslow's soothing syrup, the little darling wakes up bright as a button. If the little darling woke up at all, it's been discovered that Mrs. Winslow's soothing syrup had chloroform in it. One of his greatest pleasures was to motor through France with chauffeur and often in the company of his publisher and friend Grant Richards. On such tours, they would look at church architecture and, above all, indulge their liking for fine food and wine. Richard records that only once did he ever see Houseman in a bar and that he never saw him drunk, but how good a witness is Richards as a drinking companion. On one occasion, following a visit to Italy, Richards appealed to Houseman for confirmation that an official town reception had been laid on in Houseman's honour. Houseman replies,
the municipal hospitality of Ventimiglia must have made me very drunk, for I forget the whole affair. My recollection is that you and I climbed in mist or drizzle a hill with a castle on it, that we lunched at a restaurant where you, after much palaver, induced the proprietor to furnish us with a viand which I did not much admire, small envelopes of paste, enclosing minced meat. And then we walked through the town and under some trees by the shore to a rough stone breakwater. But I suppose I dreamt all this while I was under the table.
The two of them were constantly recommending wines, restaurants and food to each other. The following from Hausmann at the Hotel Continental in Paris is typical.
I have been to the Ecu de France, which is good and evidently very successful, rather uncomfortably crowded after eight. I ate the two things given most prominence in the menu and praised by the patron or chef d'hôtel or whoever he was. They were régional, which meant Norman. One was a sole with mushrooms, certainly very good, though it's not a mixture I approve of. The other was deadly dull, boiled or stewed fowl with mushrooms again, though not the same sort, and the hard, uneatable parts of artichoke leaves. The patron or patron stands over the waiters while they serve one in a menacing manner, so it is clear that their heads will be cut off if they fall short in anything. When I started to order Burgundy, the sommelier insisted on Chambord Musigny 1921, which was most excellent. Though bouillabaisse was not on the menu, the restaurant was faintly pervaded by that agreeable smell, or something very like it.
His relationship with Richards was also that of author to publisher, and he would joke about it by saying things like, "I shall be there about 9 o'clock, just drunk enough to be pleasant, but not so incapable as a publisher would like an author to be." Or in prospect of crossing the English Channel during wartime in 1916, "I've just applied for leave to go through Folkestone and Dieppe by 7 p.m. from Charing Cross on Wednesday the 19th. After all, a quick death is better than a slow journey. And as I am only an author and not a publisher, I am comparatively well prepared to meet my God." Hausmann, who I think was indifferent to money, was certainly generous towards Richards, lending him sums of £500 and £250 when his business was in trouble. £500 was half of Hausmann's annual salary at the time. He never cared whether the loans were repaid, which in Richards's case is just as well, but one thing he did care about was publication. He wrote more letters to his publisher than to anyone else, and they show his close involvement in every aspect of the publishing process. He's very knowledgeable about print runs, typography, paper, prices, binding, page layout, decorations, advertisements, complimentary copies, copyright, and costs. Throughout his life, he handled permissions personally. His manner when responding to applications often enlivens a tedious business, as when he gives permission to Ivor Gurney, who was an unofficial assistant organist at Gloucester Cathedral at the time.
"My dear Richards, Mr. I.B. Gurney, who resides in Gloucester Cathedral, along with St. Peter and Almighty God, must not print the words of my poems in full on concert programmes, a course which I'm sure his fellow lodgers would disapprove of. But he is quite welcome to set them to music and to have them sung and to print their titles on programmes when they are sung."
Hausmann kept a close eye on publication timetables, writing to Richards when an overlong delay seems to have occurred.
"My dear Richards, a month ago you wrote to say that you were informed that Manilius II was on the sea. Where are you now informed that it is? At the bottom? Or is the vessel approaching London via Yokohama? Yours sincerely, A.E. Hausmann."
On misprints, he kept an even closer eye. They must have been particularly vexing to someone like him, though sometimes he managed to retain good humour.
"My dear Richards, thanks to your treatment last night, I'm quite restored to health this morning. I enclose a copy of our joint work. The results of your collaboration are noted on pages 4, 22, 45, 55, 71, 77, 78, 92, 116. This last occurred also in the previous edition where I overlooked it. I don't mark details of punctuation. I am bound to say, however, that the leather binding makes a very pretty book."
When the printers in the final stage removed punctuation from the ends of the first two lines of a poem in Last Poems, and Richards offered to put in an errata slip, he replied famously,
"Now don't put in an errata slip. The blunder will probably enhance the value of the first edition in the eyes of bibliophiles, an idiotic class."
Richards was his most frequent correspondent, his sister Kate next. But there are nearly 470 correspondents in all, and many letters bear witness to Houseman's sociability, dealing as they do with invitations or replies to invitations to meet, dine, or stay. There are letters to other writers, such as Robert Bridges, John Drinkwater, T.S. Eliot, E.M. Forster, Thomas Hardy, John Masefield, and W.B. Yeats, to men of letters such as Edmund Gosse and M.R. James, to colleagues at London and Cambridge, but also many to admirers who sometimes were interested only in acquiring a reply in his handwriting. Among them was one James George Lippert, who ingenuously professed to have been christened Alfred Edward in the hope of collecting autograph replies. Another was Charles Wilson from County Durham in England, who repeatedly pestered Houseman with trivial requests and gifts, and who is known to have sold manuscript letters of the poet while he was still alive. Houseman had a very defined sense of what he was about, and many letters, courteous though they are, involve saying no one way or another. No, he will not contribute a poem to a magazine. No, he will not stand as public orator at Cambridge. No, he's completely unsuited to giving the Clark lectures at Trinity College. No, his poems may not be printed on a concert programme, and so on. He refused at least 9 honorary degrees. The only public honour he did accept was an honorary fellowship of St. John's, his old Oxford college. He even refused, to his family's consternation, the very high honour of the Order of Merit.
"Dear Lord Stamfordham, with all gratitude for His Majesty's most kind and flattering wish to confer upon me the Order of Merit, I humbly beg permission to decline this high honour. I hope to escape the reproach of thanklessness or churlish behaviour by borrowing the words in which an equally loyal subject, Admiral Cornwallis, declined a similar mark of the royal favour. I am, unhappily, of a turn of mind that would make my receiving that honour the most unpleasant thing imaginable. I am yours very truly, A. E. Houseman."
He was the first, however, to congratulate others on their receiving public honours, but felt that they were not for him. The reason for the refusals seems to have been that he despised himself for wishing to be well known. Against the review of T.E. Lawrence's 7 Pillars of Wisdom, which contained the passage, "There was a craving to be famous and a horror of being known to like being known, contempt for my passion for distinction made me refuse every honor offered honor," Houseman wrote, "This is me." When he was well known, both as a poet and scholar, letters arrived in ever greater numbers. When he was terminally ill in the evening nursing home at Cambridge, they continued to arrive. And even though his command of word formation and syntax sometimes suffered from the medication he was taking, he still made a heroic effort to reply. The first signs of the approaching end came in 1933, 3 years before his death, when he began to suffer from unfocused anxiety, especially early in the morning. But he was consistently sanguine and stoical in the face of deteriorating health, as when he wrote to his sister Kate at the end of 1934.
"I am just about the same, with frequent feelings of fatigue, occasional sinkings at the heart, and continual uneasiness at beginning to get up in the morning. I can bear my life, but I do not at all want it to go on, and it is a great mistake that it did not come to an end 1.5 years ago. This period has been a serious subtraction from the total pleasure, such as it was, of my existence. I'm not doing anything important but putting together notes from my margins to print from time to time. I am much annoyed by being told by everyone how well I look and being admired for my comparative youthfulness and my upright carriage.
On the 27th of July 1935, he expresses much the same attitude to his publisher, Grant Richards.
The continuation of my life beyond May 1933 was a regrettable mistake, and the bright side of the weakening of my health since the end of February is that it encourages me to hope for an earlier termination of the affair. The heart is regarded by the doctor as the chief culprit, but partly it is just old age and partly a nervous disorder. I've been passing a quiet 3 weeks in the country.
His rooms at Trinity College were at the end of a long staircase. On 9th of June 1935, he remarked to his brother Lawrence, "I still go up my 44 stairs two at a time, but that's in hopes of dropping dead at the top." Recognizing that there was an inconvenience, the college authorities arranged for him to be moved to ground floor rooms in the Great Quad in 1935 so that he would be more comfortable. They even silenced the Trinity clock so that he could sleep undisturbed. He was back in the nursing home when on the 21st of April 1936 he received a request for a contribution to the London Mercury from its editor R.A. Scott James. He replied,
"My dear sir, I am obliged by your letter, but my career, and it is to be hoped my life, are so near their close that it is to be hoped that they will concern neither of us much longer. Yours very truly, A. Houseman."
The next day, he told S.C. Roberts that he hoped to attend a meeting of the family, a select Cambridge dining club to which he belonged. Roberts recorded, "He came. He looked terribly ill, and shortly after we had sat down to dinner, he confessed to me that he felt sick. I took him into the bedroom and asked him whether I should get a taxi to take him back to Trinity. No, he said, he would rather come back to the table. Having nibbled a little toast and drunk a glass of burgundy, he left early." On the 23rd of April, he told his friend Stephen Gaisley, "I gave my first lecture yesterday with no difficulty, but in general I'm pretty rotten." The master of Trinity, Sir John Thompson, records, "He continued to give his lectures even after his health broke down, sometimes coming from the nursing home to the lecture room and going back there as soon as the lecture was over. I saw him on the day of his last lecture. He was terribly ill and must have had invincible determination to lecture in such a state. He was taken to the nursing home the next day." On April 25th, he wrote a postcard to his sister Kate.
"Back to Evelyn Nursing Home today. A.E.H. Ugh."
5 days later, at the age of 77, this remarkable man was dead. Thank you, and we look forward to seeing you at the reception.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.